simultaneously. And I think he's right in this regard. I think that what we've seen and what we've witnessed in this moment is the bankruptcy of a particular economic ideological philosophy that has left so many people behind, and I think we need to dare to imagine a new world. But I think it's going to require strategic and tactical thinking, and I think on its face, Chris and I aren't disagreeing. I just think there are ways to get to the same end.
Eddie Glaude, chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. We spoke to them Wednesday night during our debate night special broadcast. To watch the full special, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nardina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, and Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Laguerra, Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Aaron Dooley, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gadars, and Anthony Manzo. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. Again, our website is democracynow.org to see all our WebExes. That's our web exclusives. And all our coverage of the presidential debates, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival, Thursday through Sunday, October 20th through 23rd, at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival is the premier environmental film festival in the United States Pacific Northwest, showing the very best films about nature, the environment, outdoor pursuits, and eco-conscious living. Films that will be shown include Seed, The Untold Story, Silent Running, Saving Jamaica Bay, and many more. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival, Thursday through Sunday, October 20th through 23rd, at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher, and Afro jazz bandleader lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland. Printed Oregon and Multnomah County nonpartisan voter guides in English and Spanish are available in many locations, including all branches of the Multnomah County Library and online at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a traveling activist group opposing abortion rights will be stopping in Portland on Saturday.
The coalition opposing the proposed Millennium Coal Terminal in Longview is gearing up for the last round of public comment on this controversial project.
And we'll have a live discussion with Moses Ross of the Multnomah County Charter Review Commission about a ballot measure that would overhaul campaign financing in the county.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 20th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. The movement against abortion rights plans a major event in Portland this Saturday. What is being called the United 40 Days for Life campaign stops in Portland on October 22nd at 2:30 p.m. for a picket line outside the Lovejoy Surge Center. On their website, the campaign is tallying the number of women who have chosen not to enter the clinics and saying each of those incidents is, quote, a life saved from abortion. The Texas-based Anti-Choice Project is sending protesters on a bus tour of 50 states in 40 days, blockading women's health clinics at each stop. A counter demonstration is expected.
The upcoming elections on November 8th include a local measure that would profoundly change the way money is both given and how it is spent in Multnomah County elections. Here to speak about this with us here at KBOO is Moses Ross of the Multnomah County Charter Review Committee. Thanks for coming in, Moses.
Thank you very much.
So let's start off by talking about the County Charter Review Committee itself, what kind of things you do and who you
Absolutely.
Are.
I was honored to be a member of that Charter Review Committee. Fundamentally, what it is a the County Commission is empowered to appoint a diverse variety of citizens from Multnomah County every 6 years to review the charter of Multnomah County, the charter, the bylaws, basically how we govern ourselves here in Multnomah County. And the concept is very simply put, if there is a problem, how do you fix it? Through the charter. Well, we addressed a couple of different issues, and our results of our discussions led to putting on the November ballot for the voters to decide a couple of different issues. One of them was campaign finance reform. We found in our investigation of this over 6 months that there was a challenge for citizens in Multnomah County to be able to get through the thick wall of and participate a thick wall of monies that disempowers folks from being able to run for office. And there's a lot of good people that are left off to the side. So we, as a committee, decided, a majority of us voted in favor of putting on changing the review, the charter, to include campaign finance reform, these campaign finance reform measures. So it'll be on the ballot this November.
And how many members are there on the review committee?
If I remember correctly, there were 15 different individuals from all around Multnomah County. They were chosen by their state senator or by their state representative to ensure a good diverse mix of folk from Multnomah County.
I see. And this got on the ballot with just the 15 of you deciding that it was going to be on the ballot?
Correct. And that's what's so unique about this, because it was truly grassroots and citizen-driven. Without that intermediary that is there, the elected officials. And, you know, we just found that there is such a vested interest with, you know, retaining the current system that it had to start somewhere. And we found we had a really golden opportunity here to express Multnomah County values.
Well, could you do a little explanation for the listeners of the specifics of the wording of the measure 26-184 in the Multnomah County part of your voter's pamphlet?
That's right. Fundamentally, it's a three-legged stool that is being addressed here, and that is first, contributions, the money that is required, that is given to a candidate or to a campaign. We have put a cap on that. We've also worded it in a way that contributions cannot come from corporations. So we put that necessary cap on how much an individual or an entity can contribute in an election cycle. The second part of that is expenditures. We put a cap on expenditures that a committee can have. Third, we disclosure, and this is the one that is near and dear to my heart, is the fact that we are requiring that the top five contributors to any campaign must be included on any advertising from that campaign. And so in an attempt for this transparency that we felt that is being lost with the current system.
And does it address PACs?
PACs are included in the cap restrictions. What it does do is that an individual can have, there's a $500 limit for an individual or an entity. And then also it allows for the creation of small donor committees. And the small donor committees are limited to a $100 contribution per individual or per individual or entity to that, pardon me, not entity, but individual, to that small donor committee. So that allows for a pooling of resources, a pooling of citizen money to be able to contribute to a campaign that is favored. There is a cap on how much, I think if I remember correctly, it's $10,000 that the small donor committee can contribute to one candidate.
Uh-huh. So up until now, how has money been spent on campaigns, and was there an incident that led you to start this movement?
Well, I was stricken by the fact that, in the last race for county commission chair, over $460,000 was raised and spent by the candidates, by the winning candidate. And I realized that is prohibiting good people from being able to run because of the networking within a certain income strata that you have to work with to be able to raise that kind of money. You have to be very well connected into the current system. And there's a lot of people out there, good people, intelligent people, and wise people that could help us govern this county in accordance to our county values that are being excluded from the political process. And so we felt very strongly that we had an opportunity here with the charter process to enact this.
And specifically, how does the money get spent? Is it generally just on advertising or to
phone banks? Currently, it's like a little microcosm of marketing, if you will, the fact that you have to be able to raise name awareness of your candidate or of your issue, which requires you going to mass media outlets and means to be able to get the word out about a candidate or an issue. And that just comes into the tens and hundreds of thousands to do it effectively, depending if you're using broadcast media or using print media, so you're having to pay for all of this. And to do a proper job with a county that have 800,000 or a million people, it gets very, very expensive, a major metro. So what we have done here is brought that down so it's an even playing field. And that's, I think, and it forces that candidate, or allows that candidate, I should say, to be able to talk to individuals and for those and explain to the individual, illustrate to that voter why they're a good person to vote for. And if they want to, mm-hmm. they can then in turn make a contribution to that
person.
That's
going to include, graphic arts and also the
Gets so darn expensive to run a campaign nowadays. So we got to level the playing field.
So in your discussions on the committee, what concerns have you come up with if this does not pass?
Well, if it doesn't pass, then we have to wait for the state legislature or other efforts like this on a municipal level to enact some form of campaign finance. I don't think, this is a unique opportunity. Doing something different than the current status quo is always difficult. I point, for instance, to once again, correlating it to the values of the folks that live in Multnomah County, the people in Multnomah County. Our county commission, 15 years ago, bucked the trend and allowed for gay marriage licenses. At the time it was illegal. But they did it because it was a honest expression of the values of our county. And once again, I think, this type of reform that's why we used this route was the best route to use.
I see. And is this the first time you know of that any county in Oregon has tried to limit?
Oh, I think there's been other attempts. Quite frankly, the challenge we found to enact campaign finance reform is a pretty fundamental one, 15 years ago, the Oregon Supreme Court said that campaign contributions are a form of free speech, and so they can't be restricted. We took that into account when we were in our deliberation and in presenting this, but we felt we welcome it. We welcome the challenge, because you have to kick the legal system. You got to start somewhere. And if we establish a precedent through this, times have changed over the last 15 years, and I think there's a higher recognition of the need for this type of reform.
Well, we really appreciate the legality you getting that on the ballot. You know, it's really important that we're going to get to vote on it now. Well, thanks for coming in, Moses.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Moses Ross of the Multnomah County Charter Review Committee. You can find out even more about Measure 26-184 in your voter's pamphlet or online at www.multclib.org/elections.
This coming Monday, the 24th of October, marks the last time public input will be accepted on the Millennium Coal Terminal in Longview, Washington. The terminal has been in the works for 6 years in the port city 50 miles north of Portland. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke to Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey, the senior organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper.
When we started fighting coal export, you know, we had 6 proposals across our 2 states, and now, thanks to outstanding community opposition, only Millennium remains in Longview.
Who makes up this coalition that has been opposing it?
I think many KBOO listeners would consider themselves, you know, active participants in the campaign to keep coal export out of the Pacific Northwest, but we've had amazing support from the health community, the faith community, the fishing community, the tribes have stood up in opposition, the tribes along the Columbia River and many throughout the Pacific Northwest. And then, of course, environmental groups such as Columbia Riverkeeper are also part of this fight.
The hearing that's coming up on the 24th on Monday is being held by the Army Corps of Engineers, and you say that they are taking a very narrow scope in their look at what the impacts of this coal terminal could be. And what do you mean by that exactly? How narrow?
Yeah, so the Army Corps of Engineers chose to essentially look at what the project's impacts would be, you know, within the boundary of the terminal site itself. They really did not take into account, well, they certainly did not take into account the broader implications of the burning of 44 million tons of coal a year. They didn't look at the rail impacts to Washington State. They, you know, very narrowly addressed, you know, coal dust concerns and impacts to the Columbia River. And the conclusions that they came to were essentially that, you know, this coal terminal will have no impact to tribal fisheries. It will have very little impact to air quality. It will have, you know, very little impact to the Columbia River.
Those conclusions, as you said, they were referring to, like, just the site of the terminal itself?
Right. I mean, it's just like, you know, when you have a stain on your shirt, if you look at it close enough, it doesn't look like a stain anymore because that's all you see. And that's the way that they approached their environmental review for Millennium. Unfortunately, this is a draft, and they are required by law to take public comment on ways that they should improve their environmental review. And that's why the public hearing in Longview is so important. And we're encouraging folks to come from all around the region and, you know, give your 2 minutes of public testimony, you know, in front of the audience or privately to a court reporter, or just submit it in writing, and make sure that the Army Corps, you know, doesn't look the other way at the broader impacts of coal export.
This coming Monday from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Cowlitz County Expo Center in Longview, Washington.
Yes, and if folks are looking for transportation, we have a couple options from Portland. We have a bus that's leaving from 11:30 a.m. At Holiday Park, and it will come back around 6 o'clock And then in Vancouver, if listeners are in Vancouver, there's meetups happening at noon at the Salmon Creek Park and Ride, and at 6 p.m. at St. Luke's Episcopal Church on East 4th Plains. So those are sort of ways that people can come to the hearing without, you know, driving yourself.
This can be a very long process with a lot of different steps. And so where is Millennium in that process right now to full approval and building?
Yeah, so the next step is a final environmental impact statement. So it will take some months for the Army Corps of Engineers to process and respond to the comments that they received during this comment period, which actually goes until November 29th. So if people want to write in their comments later, they are more than welcome to. And then with the release of the final environmental impact statement, that's the document that agencies will make their decisions on, so whether this meets the permitting requirements that they have. And when environmental reviews are inadequate, decision makers don't have the best available information to either issue a permit or deny a permit. And that's why we want to make sure that during this draft phase where they're accepting comments for future amendments to the environmental impact statement, we want to make sure that they get strong comments and really do revise their environmental impact statement so it's strong enough for agencies to make strong, you know, smart decisions.
Lastly, have you heard much from the city of Longview itself? Do you know how people who are living there feel about this proposed terminal?
Yeah, so folks in Longview are well aware of who Millennium is. They first met Millennium when they came into town proposing a 5 million ton coal export terminal. And it wasn't until internal documents revealed that they intentionally kept their true expansion plans from the public and elected decision makers. So people understand and remember that Millennium's first introduction to the community was an outright lie. And it has been 6 years since Millennium, you know, came to town, and people are still showing up to workshops, showing up to meetings, showing up and volunteering. To have an issue like this go on for so long and to not have a dip in interest or have people get distracted by other issues really shows how much the community is concerned and opposed to this project.
Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey with the Columbia Riverkeeper, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The National Lawyers Guild and the American Civil Liberties Union of North Dakota have filed a Freedom of Information Act request. It was submitted today to probe secret government surveillance of the protests at Standing Rock, who are blocking the Dakota Access Pipeline, LLC. The two civil rights groups sent information requests to 16 municipal and federal agencies requesting, quote, all surveillance information and communications regarding the DAPL protests from April 1 to the present. The list ranges from the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Homeland Security, to the Highway Patrol, the Sheriff, and the police departments in North Dakota. The water protectors have been peaceful, but law enforcement agencies have repeatedly been filmed attacking them. In one instance, poorly trained police dogs were used to attack unarmed demonstrators in a situation that saw a child bitten by a dog. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Was arrested after filming and reporting on the dog attacks. All charges were dropped Monday in that case against Amy Goodman. The National Lawyers Guild and the American Civil Liberties Union said in a statement, quote, water protectors have come to expect surveillance and interference from law enforcement.
The Fourth Dimension Recovery Center is holding a series of upcoming events. Here to talk about that is 4D peer director Tony Vesna. Thanks for coming, Tony.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
First off, talk about your work at 4D Recovery. What do you do?
Well, my job primarily is to organize events. I supervise all the peer services there. I write the contracts. We're also a small nonprofit, so a lot of the job duties kind of intermix between everybody. So I just do a little bit of everything.
Is there a philosophy Is there a philosophy behind your approach to this work?
Yeah, there is. 4D's mission is just to provide a safe, fun environment for young people. And we say young people are people under 35 and younger, to have a fun and safe environment that's free from drugs and alcohol so they can find recovery. And really, a lot of what we do is derived from philosophies within Alcoholics Anonymous, giving back to people, reaching out to the newcomer, lowering the bar, so to speak.
Great. Is there any specific kind of drug that is more often abused than others?
You know, it's kind of hard to differentiate between which drugs are abused more. We know that across the nation and here in Oregon that there's a rise in opiate use, including heroin. And we know that young people are more likely to use than any other group. When I say young, I'm talking about emerging adults, 18 to 25, about 1 in 5 nationally reported in 2014 to using illicit drugs. Additionally, younger people, 18 to 25, are less likely to get the treatment they need. So in Oregon, in 2014, only about 14% of the people between the ages of 18 and 25 actually got the treatment services that they needed.
Oh, wow. Talk about your upcoming events. What's going on?
Okay, so we got lots of upcoming events. The first one I'd like to talk about is Friendsgiving Day, and that's going to happen on Thanksgiving. And so what we're going to do is a two-part thing. The first part will just kind of be a community day. People who are early in recovery or who are in recovery can come into 40 with their families between 11 in the morning and 7 and just hang out, play video games, watch movies. We're going to provide a free dinner at 3. We also invite people who are coming to bring a potluck. The second part of it is we're doing a item drive right now for clothing, like socks and beanies, items for like brushing your teeth and stuff. And then on Thanksgiving Day at 7, we're going to go out in the community and hand out these items in like a gift bag to individuals facing homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Who do you hope will come?
I mean, I hope people, you know, younger people in recovery come who need a safe place to go. For me, when I was in treatment, I didn't have a lot of places to go during Thanksgiving. And there's a thing at the Alano Club where you could come and have a free dinner, and there's other people in recovery. And it just helped me in the beginning to feel welcome, wanted, and needed. So we're hoping those people come.
Oh, great. And what is it that 4D Recovery does differently than other programs?
Well, we're kind of similar to some other programs. What makes us different from treatment is we don't actually provide substance abuse treatment. What we are is a community center, so like a drop-in center. People can come in during the day, and then we have peer services. And what peer services it means is that somebody who identifies in recovery, who has got a couple years sober, gets a 40-hour training and provides services to individuals like, hey, you want to get your license? I can help you do that. You need some help navigating the court? I can help you do that. We help people get their kids back. We help people get into college. We help people do a myriad of things, overcome a myriad of barriers that they have for their recovery.
Mm-hmm. And Tony, what's going on with your fundraiser?
Okay, so that's a really important thing. So our second annual fundraiser called Gratitude Night is going to happen December 3rd. It's going to be at the 4D location, which is 3807 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, which is adjacent to Planned Parenthood. Doors open at 6 p.m. It's going to be completely catered. There's going to be beverages, live music. There'll be a silent and live auction. Organizations can purchase tables for $350, that seat about 6. And then individual seats go for $50. Gratitude Night tickets can be found on our website and on Facebook. So that's www.4drecovery.org. And you can purchase a table there. And so we're trying to raise money to essentially buy the building we're in.
Oh, wow. And that was at 3807 Northeast MLK Boulevard, Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Yeah.
That's also where people can drop things off for the the drive and everything.
Yep.
And do you have any other specific goals by the end of the year for your fundraising?
Well, I mean, ultimately, what we need to do is we need to buy the building. And so it's really important. Mm-hmm. You know, the cost of rent in Northeast Portland is going up. I'm sure everyone's aware of that issue. And so if we don't have a stable place, you know, inside of Multnomah County, it's hard for people to get there. That's why we like our central location. Other things that people could do to help us is they could go to our website and donate. We're also running a pumpkin sale right now. So we got some pumpkins sourced from Savi's Island and Trader Joe's. And we got about 200. You can come through and buy a pumpkin, snap a picture, put it up on Facebook, and help your local nonprofit.
Oh, great. Well, thanks for coming in, Tony. That was Tony Vesna of Fourth Dimension Recovery Center. Find their schedule of activities at www.4drecovery.org. That's the number 4, 4drecovery.org. Thank you.
Well, we here in the KBOO News Department have been at a loss as to how to cover this presidential debate cycle. Will Trump attempt a coup d'etat? Is Clinton telling the truth about her change of heart over the TPP? KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has a few final words to help put to rest this final presidential debate.
I can't wait for the last debate and the election to be over. Less than 3 weeks to go until we know that Donald Trump's threat is over. A woman in the White House is something to feel good about, even a one percenter and war hawk. But won't it be strange when next year's nothing changed and we got only bad laws and scare talk? Our diets will be leaner, the police will get meaner, and hope an endangered species. It takes more than a vote to change the course of our boat as we try to assemble the pieces. Let's survive, jive, and thrive. Dance, romance, and take chances. Lose your earbuds and talk face to face. All changes start local, our approach multifocal, as our new world begins to take shape. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael. Take a couple minutes to vote while you're improving the world around you.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth at 5:45, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around organizing in the Black African community of Greater Portland, as well as music of all genres. Tomorrow's weather has been canceled, but please tune in for a repeat of today's weather, with a high of 61, a low of 54, and a 60% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1944, an above-ground tank holding liquefied natural gas, or LNG, exploded in Cleveland, Ohio. The explosion leveled a square mile of the city and killed 130 people. Also, in 1951, Black college football player Johnny Bright was violently assaulted during a game by Oklahoma A&M player Will Banks Smith, whose team had been targeting Bright the whole game. Despite a broken jaw, Bright threw a 61-yard touchdown pass immediately afterwards. No action was ever taken against Smith. The quote of the day is from the author and diarist, Anais Nin. Shame is the lie someone told you about yourself.
A study concerning the costs of pollution throughout the continent of Africa has been released by the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, and this study has found that air pollution is the worst environmental hazard on the continent. The study is the first attempt to calculate the total premature deaths from air pollution in Africa and the economic costs of those deaths. Outdoor and indoor air pollution combined to cause over 700,000 premature deaths in the year 2013. This is far more than were caused by unsafe water, malnutrition, or by bad sanitation. Air pollution is also the only one of those environmental hazards that is on the rise across Africa, as increasing development has slowly reduced deaths from bad water and sanitation. Premature deaths from outdoor air pollution rose 36% between the years of 1990 and 2013, alongside the steady urbanization of Africa's population. Indoor air pollution has always been a problem in Africa due to the burning of garbage, due to inefficient stoves, and the use of diesel generators. But premature deaths from it have also increased by 18% during that period. The study points out that, unlike other areas with highly polluted air, such as China and India, African countries often do not have the economic stability necessary to focus their resources on solving or reducing the air pollution problem.
In Nigeria, women are fleeing settlements near the commercial capital of the country, Lagos, where there's been an increase in particularly violent sexual attacks, with even children maimed or killed after being raped. Women's rights activists are urging authorities to do more to protect them. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
These protesters, mainly women, have had enough of rapists terrorizing their community. Singing in the local Yoruba language, they call on authorities to apprehend the perpetrators. The protesters are from Ebeche, a group of communities just outside Lagos. In recent months, there has been a spate of particularly violent cases of rape in the area. While sexual violence is certainly not uncommon in Nigeria, the Ebeche attackers often leave their victims severely injured. One woman, 85 years old, describes what happened to her.
He cut my nose into pieces. He just injured me. There was blood all over my body. Maybe he thought I was dead. It seemed like when he threw me to the ground, he thought I was dead. It wasn't until I opened my eyes that I knew how badly he had injured me.
In the hospital, doctors teach her left nose partially shot, making it very difficult for her to breathe properly and leaving her face permanently disfigured. Community leaders say on average, there's one case of rape or attempted rape each week. Like this elderly woman, some have survived despite severe injuries. At least one person has died as a result of the attacks, and the victims include children as young as 5 years old. Many frightened women have fled the community. Those who remain, like this woman from Ebeche, are terrified. Betty Abba is with Sea Hope, a group that works to stem the tide of sexual violence in the country. She says the situation in Ebeche is not isolated. Abba says rape culture is growing in Nigeria, in part because offenders are usually not punished.
Every single day there are cases of rape, especially of minors. This is not just normal. This is not like we've always had it. From all indication, the cases are on the rise. So we even have many more cases that are not reported to show you how huge a problem that is. Until we are able to apply the law to ensure that there's deterrence, it will continue.
Lagos is Nigeria's commercial capital. With a population of 20 million people and growing, it's the largest city not only in Nigeria, but in all of Africa. Ebeche, a community at the outskirts of Lagos, sits in the banks of the Lagos Lagoon. In recent years, communities like Ebeche have grown tremendously as Lagos spreads at the outskirts of the city. Police records show that Lagos has one of the highest rates of rape in Nigeria. But police spokesperson Dolapo Badmus says the police have stepped up efforts to curb the crime.
So at our end, we've been prosecuting them. So every other day we send cases of rape to court. I think last week Wednesday we still sent a man that defiled 18-month-old baby to court. We are meticulous about evidence gathering, and about exhibit gathering to ensure that none of the culprit escape justice.
According to the Nigerian Criminal Code, anyone found guilty of rape can be sentenced to as much as life in prison. But rights activists dispute police claims of aggressive prosecution, saying that the number of rape cases is high, while offenders are rarely convicted. In the northeastern state of Borno, where the Boko Haram insurgency has displaced more than 2 million people, the government has launched a martial arts self-defense training program against rape like this one. 1,000 internally displaced persons who will soon return to their communities are being trained to serve as vanguard of the fight against rape when they return home. But beyond self-defense training, which seemingly places the onus on the victims, there are no tangible government-sponsored programs that address the growing rape culture in Lagos. And many here feel authorities must do more. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Kurdish Peshmerga fighters have opened a new front in the assault on the city of Mosul in northern Iraq this morning. The offensive has been underway since Monday, with the most intense fighting so far occurring today, as the Iraqi and Kurdish militaries try to retake villages and heights surrounding the city. Mosul has been in the hands of the so-called Islamic State group since June of 2014. Since then, reports of human rights abuses, targeting of minorities, and destruction of cultural artifacts have trickled out of the city along with refugees. Once the second city of Iraq, Mosul's once diverse population of 2 million has been reduced by at least half, with anyone who is not a Sunni Muslim facing serious persecution. Hundreds of people have fled the city recently ahead of what promises to be a destructive battle. Then they've been bringing with them information about the Islamic State tactics and atrocities being committed. Most observers of the fighting worry about what will happen after the city is retaken. Other cities recaptured by Iraqi forces, including Ramadi, Tikrit, and Fallujah, experienced wholesale destruction and sporadic sectarian reprisals after being retaken. The Kurdish and Iraqi assaults on Mosul are being backed up by U.S. air power, which was crucial to capturing several towns to the north this morning. The United States also has about 300 special forces who are embedded with the Peshmerga.
Undaunted by reports of a crackdown on the press, a kitten made a surprise appearance during a live Turkish news broadcast on Monday. The kitten materialized during a morning newscast and proceeded to crawl across the desk and settle on the DRT reporter's lap. The reporter can be seen petting the cat as the broadcast came to a close. It was later reported that the cat was adopted by an employee of the station. The appearance of the cat appeared to have had a calming effect on the anchor, and it has been suggested that kittens should be allowed to the presidential debates.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving, Sam Bowman, and special thanks to Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News. They can be found at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOONEWS. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KABU, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, guest host Linda Olson, Osterlund, leads a call-in discussion asking women to share stories about being groped against their will. At 9 on Veterans Voice, Angie and Marvin welcome former drone technician Sean Westmoreland to talk about the harsh realities of drone warfare. At 10, it's Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Robin Shanti speaks with Dell Borgum, director of the Living Dying Project, and Betsy Toll, founder director of Living Earth, about healing at the edge, practices for living and dying. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The presidential candidates failed to mention climate change during the final debate last night. But this morning, KABU's Teresa Mitchell brought live on the air Bill McKibben. We feature here a brief excerpt from the one-hour interview. You can hear the whole thing on our website, www.kboo.org.
Today, I'm joined by best-selling author, environmentalist activist, and leader of 350.org, Bill McKibben. He is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College and the recipient of the Gandhi Peace Award. Bill McKibben, welcome back to KBOO Radio.
Always very good to be with you.
I'm so glad that you could join us. I'd like to ask you, what do you think of Proposition I-732 in Washington, the carbon tax swap?
Well, I think that I don't know an immense amount about it, but I know that the local chapter of 350 in Washington decided not to endorse it, and the reason that they gave was that there wasn't the full consultation with communities of color in the drafting of it. And I guess I think that the moment when the environmental movement was mostly white and didn't pay attention to frontline communities is probably it's probably a good thing that we're trying very hard to get past it now.
People of color are in a desperate fight for survival against white supremacy in our society and institutions like our police departments. So let me bring that up. What's the relation of 350.org to the fight against racial marginalization?
Well, people at 350 have worked pretty closely with Black Lives Matter across the country, and it goes in both directions. You know, it was really good to see the Black Lives Matter charter this year calling for fossil fuel divestment. People have a sense that some people think that these are all just kind of unconnected ideas, but in fact, marginalization is something that crosses the spectrum. I mean, the same people who have to worry about what happens if they get pulled over by the police are very oftentimes, the same people living in the communities who have to worry about the air they breathe because they're downwind of